You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, that is right. AUT's Alan Blackman is in studio for this week's edition of Dear Science. How are you going, Alan?
I'm doing very well, Will. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
That's good.
First up, we have a story about what Alan has described as the most important prize on the planet. Is that right?
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely.
The Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and what was done to win such a prestigious prize?
Well, before we get into that, just a brief history of the Nobel Prize for those listeners who are perhaps not aware. So this was Alfred Nobel, who made all his money in explosives way back in the day.
Yeah.
And so he developed a way of making nitroglycerin nice and safe and turned it into dynamite. So he obviously made a truckload of money in his lifetime because his will stipulated the Nobel Prizes, and these have been going for 116 years now, and a little bit longer since his death. And this year, each Nobel Prize is worth $1.5 million New Zealand dollars. So you can imagine that must have been a fair old whack of money that he had in his will to keep on pumping out.
So it was actually done after he died, not during his lifetime?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he died in about 1897 or so, and the first Nobel Prizes were 1901. And so there's five of them every year. The economics one is just a pretend one. So that was developed by the Bank of Sweden or whatever. So it's not a real Nobel Prize.
Oh, okay. So
$1.5 million for a Nobel Prize. So sadly, that means that you can win more in Powerball than, you know, devoting your life to improving the planet and winning a Nobel Prize and et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, but as Will said, the Nobel Prize for Chemistry was announced last week. And it was given to three scientists, as it seems to be more and more often done. Okay. So they seem to be group efforts, which just goes to show that science is not a one-person thing. Oh, very, very, very rarely is. So these three scientists, so Jacques Dubochet, Joachim Frank, and Richard Henderson from Lausanne in Switzerland, Columbia University in the States, and Cambridge in the UK, respectively. And the citation on their Nobel Prize was for developing cryo-electron microscopy for the high-resolution structural determination of biomolecules in solution.
What? I don't know any of that. I'm the least sciencey person. Explain that in, I don't know, my brain terms.
Okay, here we go. So we're made up of molecules. And big ones, small ones. We're made up of lots of water, we're made up of DNA, we're made up of proteins, all these sorts of things. And we want to know what those molecules look like, essentially.
Yeah.
And ideally, we want to know what they look like in the state that they're in our body in, at the risk of using the word in too many times in a sentence there.
Okay.
Okay, so big biological molecules like your proteins, like your DNA, et cetera, et cetera. What we can do with those is we can crystallize those. We can make them solid, essentially.
Okay.
So if we can get them to crystallize, then we can shoot X-rays at them. And in the act of shooting X-rays at them, we can figure out what their structures are. Okay, so we can get their structures on the atomic scale. We know what atom is bonded to what. We know what their the short-term order is. We know what the long-range order is in these molecules, et cetera, et cetera. So we know their entire structure and what they look like. But trouble with that is we need a crystalline sample. We need to be able to crystallize them, and that's not the easiest to do with biological molecules.
Okay.
And also it means that they're solids.
So why do you need to crystallize them? Is that
because they interact with X-rays only in the crystalline form? And so that means they're solids, which is not the form that they're in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So chances are they could adopt a very, very different structure in the crystalline form than they do in the actual body. So even though it's a really useful technique and lots of work been done on that, then people wanted to know what they actually look like in solution, as it were, sort of dissolved in water, okay?
Oh, yeah.
So in the form that they are in the body.
So when it's crystallized, it's not really representative of how they function?
Yeah, actually, it can be, but you never know.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
So one way around this is to use less intense radiation than X-rays, and these are beams of electrons. And so you've all heard of an electron microscope, I'm sure, okay? So electron microscopes work in the same way that light microscopes work. So you're basically shining a beam of electrons on something, and it works in exactly the same way as a light microscope would. So you can see sort of the image, Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, we can't use light microscopes to see atoms because light, the wavelength of light is too large, so we can't resolve individual atoms. Okay.
That's mad. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. But electrons have got much shorter wavelengths. Okay.
Right.
So potentially you can resolve individual atoms with electron beams. Okay. Trouble is, you go and put a living sample under an electron beam and it'll kill it. Okay.
Okay.
Because the electrons are very, very high energy. Okay. So that means your sample is going to degrade, and you can't really do it on sort of living samples. You just got to use dead samples, and chances are it's going to destroy the samples anyway, unless they're really, really robust. So this guy, Richard Henderson, started off by thinking, well, you know, there must be a way around this. Can we use electron beams, electron microscopes, to image real biological molecules? And he started this in the 70s, and essentially the way that he did it was to use less energetic beams of electrons. And then when he did that, he found everything was fuzzy. Okay, it's like using a light microscope, but not having everything illuminated very strongly. Okay, so
yeah,
you find it hard to see things if you haven't got a really strong illumination. Okay,
mm-hmm.
same
mm-hmm.
thing with electron microscope. However, he recognized that it would be possible mathematically to be able to determine what the structures of these things are, even using these weaker beams of X-rays. Okay. But he realized that the maths would be really, really difficult to do this. And he also required to do it at very, very low temperature because that stops the damage to the samples. So that's why they call it cryo electron microscopy, because it's very, very cold. Negative 196 degrees Celsius cold.
Okay. But the cells are still alive,
now,
is that right?
Well, they're still intact, let's say.
Okay.
Okay. But the trouble with that potentially is that obviously if you freeze things down to negative 196 degrees Celsius, any water in your sample is going to turn to ice.
Yeah.
And ice crystals you don't want, because all you're going to see in your electron beam is ice crystals.
Okay.
Okay. So the trick was to be able to freeze water so that it didn't form ice crystals.
Can't you do that in like a vacuum or something? Isn't there? No?
Well,
like I say, don't know science.
Well, they found a way of doing it very, very quickly and forming not crystalline water, but glass. Water as a glass.
Okay. What?
Okay, so glass is not crystalline. It doesn't have a long range order. All of the atoms are arranged sort of haphazardly in glass. Okay.
Is the jury still out as to whether glass is a liquid or a solid?
Yeah, well, it is. You could class perhaps glass as being a liquid because supposedly it flows very, very slowly, and apparently all these old windows are thicker at the bottom than they are at the top. You could call it an amorphous solid, which just means that the constituent atoms are all over the show.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Old glass has... It's thicker at the bottom than at the top because it doesn't move during its life.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Apparently, it could be classed as a liquid, but it flows very, 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 very slowly.
Okay? I'm learning new stuff. Keep going, Alan.
So anyway, they had to freeze water really, really quickly so that it would turn into a glass rather than a crystalline solid. And that's what these other guys did. So one of them worked out the maths. The other one worked out how to freeze these things really, really quickly so that they'd make glass, or as they call it, vitreous water. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they put it all together, and basically it worked, and now they can get atomic resolution structures of these biomolecules, these really, really important biomolecules, and most importantly, they can get them in water. Okay, so it's water as a glass, but it's still in water, so they're more in their natural environment, and their structure will better approximate what the actual structure is in the body. So it's really extraordinary. I mean, how the hell they did all this maths and everything, it just boggles the mind.
The thing that excites me so much about this sort of thing, and especially in the scientific field, as someone who doesn't know much about science, is just seeing, like you say, there was all these challenges that they had to face, and they were like, screw it, we're doing it. We're just going to make it happen.
Yep. So the guy that started it all off started by making these crystalline materials and using these X-rays, and then he just sort of thought, nah, bugger it, there's got to be a better way than this. And it took him 20 years, but, you know, he did get there in the end. And that's, you know, that's one of the things about our current funding system is that people want results, and they want them yesterday sort of thing.
Yeah.
So, and if you don't have those results at the end of your three-year period or whatever you get funded for, then you're not going to get it again. So it's not long-range thinking, the funding system. And you know, who knows how many great discoveries haven't been made because people haven't been willing to fund projects for, you know, a long time.
And what are the implications of a study like this? What can this be used for? What can this information
Well,
help?
there was one very important application, I guess, a couple of years ago with the Zika virus in Brazil, just when the Olympics was coming up. And so they wanted to know the structure of the virus. And so that's what this can be used for. And ordinarily, if you're going to use x-rays, you'd have to crystallize the virus, number one.
Mm-hmm.
And that could take forever, or it might not even happen at all, okay? There's no guarantees there. And so they were able to, in around about, I think something like 3 to 6 months, get the structure of this virus. And then what they do, once they know the structure of it, then they can figure out, well, maybe we could attack it at that point there with a particular molecule, and that might kill the whole thing and stuff like that. So they're looking for targets on the surface of this virus that they could potentially, you know, kill it somehow. So using particular molecules, particular drugs, whatever. So that's where the real use is in this sort of thing. So it's really sort of molecular biology and, you know, just mind-boggling stuff. Absolutely amazing.
I just can't even comprehend how anyone would go about doing that.
Likewise, really, if I'm going to be brutally honest. No, it was really amazing.
For our next story, I would like to take our listeners back in time to the 23rd of September when the world ended, did it? But, yeah. So, Alan, it seems like our genius astronomer has said, nope, he goofed up. And it is now saying that the recent earthquakes, eruptions, and weather phenomena are due to his newest prediction for the end of the world, which now includes nuclear war. Hooray!
Well, that's basically the entire story. You've got it right there. So regular listeners to Dear Science will know that, I don't know, 3 or 4 episodes ago, this fellow by the name... this fellow by the name of David Mead, who describes himself apparently as a numerologist, whatever that is, said that the world was going to end precisely in the period between the 20th and the 23rd of September. So, you know, got a lot of precision.
Wasn't he the guy that said there was a planet that we couldn't see? Planet X?
Yes, indeed. Planet X. That's the one. Or some Nerubium or some silly name.
Nerubus or something.
Yeah, yep. So he said that, so nobody could see this planet, but then it was going to collide with the Earth and the world was going to end.
Which makes sense, obviously, because if it's a planet you can't see, then it's going to collide.
Absolutely.
Space.
It was the end of the world for some people that day. So wasn't entirely wrong.
Keeping it topical, Ruben. Hey, it's not over yet.
So anyway, he said that he must have done his calculations wrong, which you'd think a numerologist would be pretty on. You know, the one thing you'd think they'd be able to do would be calculations, wouldn't you? You know.
But, maybe he just knows he can count to at least 10. He goes, I know numbers. I'm a numerologist. Oh, yeah.
So anyway, he says he got it wrong, and now he's revised the date to October the 15th, and now it's not going to all happen on October the 15th. It's going to take 7 years, apparently.
Okay.
7 years. Not 6 years and 363 days or something like that. It's got 7 years, exactly.
On the nose.
Presumably on the day. And as you say, earthquakes, hurricanes, and tsunamis apparently are going to destroy the planet, apparently.
So basically what he's done is he's watched the news and gone, oh, bad thing's happening. I'm going to capitalize on that thing. Say we're all doomed. Why do people keep on doing this? You think, especially in the modern world, we've got internet, we can look at all these things, and people predict the end of the world every second day, it seems.
Yes, they do. And one day someone's going to be right, but, you know, it's not going to be for a while yet, possibly, hopefully.
Well, I mean, a whole lot of people believe in what we think are pretty crazy things. I mean, there's a huge, quite a growing society of what's called flat earthers.
Yes, indeed.
Believe the Earth.
Actually, I was really confused today because when you sent me the links for the topics for today, I clicked on one of the suggested things in one of those science websites, and it was about, you know, the rapper B.O.B. and his flat Earth.
You're asking me if I know a rapper. Oh. Come on.
Well, he's basically this rapper who's crowdfunding through Kickstarter to send up satellites. He wants $1 million from his listeners to send up a satellite and prove that the Earth is flat. So Buzz Aldrin and a whole bunch of other astronauts and people have been up on the International Space Station, send them photos on Twitter going, you don't need to spend all that money. Donate it to Puerto Rico or somewhere that actually needs it.
Indeed.
Here's a photo of Earth. It's doctored. It's definitely doctored.
Oh, jeez.
How would you know?
How would you know? No one knows. Could be the lizard people.
Ruben, you're not helping.
Last time I saw, he was at a few hundred dollars for his campaign. Do you know where he's at now?
I think I would get it up. $1,000 mark. That's not time I want to waste on such a
piece. No, amen. Yes, yes.
For our last story, we're revisiting another old story.
Indeed.
We had about a man who was brought back to semi-consciousness from a vegetative state, but new information has surfaced showing that the man in question had died before the report was even published.
Yeah.
This seems like a pretty big thing. This seems like something that shouldn't happen, especially in a scientific study.
It's a bit, a bit sus. But again, regular listeners will remember that there was a guy who had been in a vegetative state for 15 years in France, and by stimulating the vagus nerve, the one that runs from sort of the head to your gut, they found that they were able to get him to respond. And so they only published this study last month, and they were talking apparently about him sort of in the present tense and everything when they were interviewed and stuff, but it turned out that he'd actually died in June.
Okay.
And so now obviously the question is, was that death as a result of the stimulation of the vagus nerve, or was it something else? And the workers are saying that it was a pulmonary problem, so something in the lungs or whatever. And not related, apparently, to this electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve. So, but it does seem a little weird that they, when they announced it, they didn't say that it actually passed away. So,
I mean, there is a chance that they did that just because they knew that people would react badly. But then again, announcing it after they've released the report that he died before they released the report is a little bit...
Yeah, and they would have known that people would have found out eventually anyway. So,
yeah. I mean, but
how
it doesn't
to get around this, I don't know.
Diminish the validity of the study.
Yeah.
Does it? I mean, like...
No. Well, no, I don't think it does. I mean, the major part of the study was that they managed to get this guy out of a catatonic state. And, you know, that's
amazing,
a big deal.
Regardless.
That's a big, big deal. So,
I mean, now that this sort of suspicious situation has arisen around the study, I feel like probably warrants some sort of investigation to see if the... I mean, the study was falsified or something? Because that is groundbreaking work.
Yeah, it is. And I'm sure it'll continue. But, you know, this...
You'd hope.
Just a little bit unfortunate, I guess. So, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. Sorry, my brain's losing itself somehow. Oh, question.
Yes.
You said at the beginning, vagus nerve. What is the deal with that?
So
vagus, is that like
an official
name?
Not okay. Less. Not less. No, it's spelt wrong. V-A-G-U-S.
I thought it was like a Vegas strip.
No.
Reference or something.
No.
Okay.
So, and one very quick last thing. I don't know if you heard this morning about Tillerson and Trump saying that he's got a higher IQ than Tillerson. Did you hear that?
What?
Oh, okay.
Go on.
Oh, you didn't hear that. Oh, okay. God. So this is fabulous, because apparently Tillerson called Trump a effing moron. And so Trump said that if this was true, then he would be happy to have an IQ test against Tillerson, and he said, and I know who'd win. And so now Mensa, you know, the Society of High IQ people, have come along and said we would be more than happy to host this IQ test between Trump and Tillerson. So somebody said that, you know, if they televise that, then Trump will go down as the president that paid off the national debt, you know, put it on a pay-per-view.
It's actually painful, and especially Trump with a whole bunch of other people, it's sort of turning into a dick measuring competition. Now
well,
IQ,
we know who'd win that, you know, according to him anyway. So.
Well, thank you very much, Alan, for blowing our minds and confusing our souls, as per usual.
My pleasure.
Cool. Thank you very much.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.